I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is Tech Central's Meet the CIO, the technology show where we talk to people who lead technology in business. Now, Meet the CIO is proudly brought to you by Wipro. We thank the team at Wipro for helping bring you these great interviews, and you can learn more about Wipro at wipro.com. Now, my guest on Meet the CIO today has been named as one of the top 100 influential women in tech for 2024, and she was also recognized among the elite Cyber 50 leaders in cybersecurity. She is Group IT Director at Tsebo Solutions Group and was previously CIO for Africa at Momentum Metropolitan Holdings. She has a master's degree in technology and innovation and is now pursuing her doctorate in the same field. Her name is Yoshin Pariachi, and she joins me now. Yoshin, welcome to Meet the CIO to Tech Central, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Duncan. Pleasure to be here.
You were just telling me before the show started that Tsebo Solutions Group employs some 32,000 people. That's a big organization.
It is a big organization.
How long have you been with Tsebo now?
So it's my third year at Tsebo. Prior to that, I was in financial services, so quite a big change in terms of moving into facility management.
You were at F&B previously,
I was at F&B previously, and then obviously Momentum Metropolitan from an insurance perspective. But F&B, quite a long stint, over 2 decades at F&B, so I'm an F&B baby, I guess.
Great. Well, I believe you actually started your career not in IT, but in healthcare. How do you pivot from healthcare into tech?
So I guess I landed up in tech accidentally, and that's what I say all the time. So Anyway, I grew up in a Indian township in Chatsworth, Durban, and I schooled there, and then went on to the University of KZN, and I studied biochemistry and microbiology, and I was going to find the cure for cancer and AIDS and those type of things. But, you know, tough times. And in terms of, you know, having financial resources available, I had to take a year off. So I couldn't continue. I couldn't afford to continue. And I landed a temp job on the service desk at F&B through Kelly.
Oh, yes.
So that's where the humble beginning started. It was totally an unchallenging job because you waited for the phone to ring. And there were all these techies around me loading PCs and having lots of tech talk that was way over my head.
So this was in the IT department?
In the IT department. So I used to wait for the phone to ring and be like a field controller to send a support person out. So I like begged the guys, please, I'm struggling. I'm starving. I need something inspirational to aspire to. So they decided to take me on their wing and taught me a few technical stuff. And then from there, I moved on to being a system analyst, so crawling under desks, patching network cables.
Had you ever touched a computer prior to this?
Never, never, honestly, never touched a computer. And because, I guess, in terms of, you know, the economic status at that time, you only were exposed to computers at school, and there were only a certain quota that, you know, were able to get into a computer class. And I wasn't one of those guys. So, yeah, switching on a computer the first day was quite challenging for me. But from there, I guess I felt that I was too far away in terms of delivering the service from an end product perspective to the client to get client satisfaction. So I decided, no, testing's the next best thing to get into. So, yeah, testing, test analyst, you know, manage quality products that go out, and then that was also not great because requirements weren't interpreted correctly. So moved on to system analysis and headed up a team there. Then project management, head of project management, governance and risk, application development. And then I guess my last stint at F&B was risk and governance. In terms of, well, at F&B, we called it the beast because it was a huge, huge distributed networks, branches, ATM, self-service. They call it points of presence, I think, now, from an F&B perspective. And that's when I got an opportunity to move to Metropolitan, Momentum Metropolitan. Africa was definitely the poor cousin in terms of that. So you
had that was your first CIO role.
That was my first CIO role. And it really, really challenged me in the sense that, you know, the landscape from the rest of Africa is so different in terms of managing things like, you know, getting your server to wherever you need it to be, just getting it through customs was, mm-hmm. you know, such a challenge. And also from an adoption perspective, you could come up with foolproof solutions that would, you know, meet the South African market perfectly. But when you go into you know, the rest of Africa, there were huge challenges, and you didn't have, you know, a lot of those capabilities available. So it was trying to do more with less, but also trying to modernize, you know, the Africa landscape from a Momentum Metropolitan perspective. Did some lovely things in terms of, you know, getting, you know, SD-WAN across Africa, one of those type of things. And then also at that point in time, there was this huge drive in terms of Office 365. And at that point in time, the rest of the group hadn't made a decision mm-hmm. to move. So we took the leap from an Africa perspective in terms of that.
So you must have been traveling a heck of a lot.
I did. Mm-hmm. I did travel a lot. It was rewarding, but I guess my family didn't like that much. So definitely, I guess, more balance when I moved to Sebo Solutions Group. What a wonderful opportunity. So firstly, I was really, really nervous to take the leap in the sense that, you know, financial services was my forte. I knew this, getting into a new industry. But I'm glad that I did it because, gee whiz, I think it's helped me develop exponentially. Mm-hmm. And it's also helped me harness all the, I guess, nuggets that I picked up, you know, over the years and apply to, you know, this particular industry. And from a Sebo Solutions Group perspective, the one key thing is that we high volume, but, you know, very, very low profit in mm-hmm. terms of, you know. And when you said that you were challenged financially at financial services, this is a whole new ballgame because introducing new technology meant, you know, the first thing that you met with is how many sandwiches do I need to make? Or how many toilets do I need to clean? You know, it's a totally different thing. And also, when I went into this particular position, there was almost no digital footprint, you know. So that was quite exciting in terms of how do you get to deliver that. And since then, lots of fantastic stuff. So modernizing I guess, the legacy systems and definitely digitalizing, you know, the processes, et cetera.
So what did the IT stack look like when you arrived? What does it look like today?
Okay, so the IT stack looked like you had a few enterprise solutions, okay, that were outdated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, AX 2009, end of life from an ERP perspective. The data lake or data warehouse, you couldn't call that because it was only, you know, a few ERP systems going in and the rest was manual going all around that. From a stack perspective, it was very, very, you know, standard, bespoke, but very, I guess, a manual in terms of checklists, customer surveys, lots of things run off Excel, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So definitely good processes in terms of trying to understand your business and your customers and your clients, but not great in terms of, you know, having information real time to make decisions, etc. So when I got there, they'd already started and embarked on modernizing the financial ERP, mm-hmm. Which was Microsoft Dynamics Finance and Operations. And one of the key things, I think, or trick that was missed in terms of the, you know, feasibility and requirements gathering was that the group comprises of five typically different businesses. Okay, so there might be an 80% match in terms of common stuff, mm-hmm. but that 20% was quite an important 20% for these pillars to deliver their services. So that was the first thing that we had to get right. And a year down the line, we delivered all five companies. And I see it as five different implementations of the ERP. And currently, we're now in an optimizing phase, okay. you know. So it's quite rewarding where, you know, the users have adopted the change and they now understanding, oh, but this can make it better. And I think another thing is that as much as we wanted to use mature technologies back then based on the risk appetite, but I think we transformed into using a balanced approach, you know, mature where it counted and leading and bleeding in terms of AI, IoT, you know, those type of things. So from an AI perspective, and I'm not sure if you've seen this, but we were recognized by the top employer in terms of our AI enablement, in terms of harnessing, you know, people engagement. Okay. So one of the key things from an AI perspective that that we chose to do is that we believe that we need to, you know, get rid of the mundane, repetitive tasks, okay, and empower our people to do the more complex stuff. And, you know, we're using it really well in terms of HR, legal, mm-hmm. marketing, finance, etc.
Embedded inside Microsoft Dynamics or?
So it's a combination. Mm-hmm. It's a combination. So there's certain things that come out natively. So if there's a native, plugin, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word, a native AI
tool.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the word, tool. We definitely explore that. But we've got add-ons in terms of, you know, plugins, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of the key things in terms of AI is more around the predictive analytics. So one of the things that those modern technologies have done for several, it's reshaped us as a business. You know, it's transformed us from a traditional facility management business to something that's an integrated workplace management solution provider. And I believe that with some of the stuff that we're playing with, we're not just following, you know, emerging technologies or adopting it. We're actually shaping and changing the way we do things. So, for example, in terms of operations, you know, predictive maintenance is one of the, you know, the key things, predictive analytics. In terms of workforce management, you know, scheduling, time and task, understanding those type of things. Also from a customer need perspective, in terms of monitoring electricity and water management, you know, those are key things. Right down to managing consumables, you know,
yeah.
How many sheets do I have? So, you know,
it's a very admin-driven, heavy business. I mean, maybe I should have introduced with this. So you describe yourselves as an integrated workplace management solutions provider.
Yes.
You manage canteens inside organizations. You do security. You manage cleaning, all that sort of thing. It's really company related services.
Correct.
And I imagine that's an incredibly complex thing. If you've got thousands and thousands of clients out there managing who has toilet paper and who doesn't,
yes,
must be a very administrative heavy system, a task that requires IT to get right.
It does. Mm. It does to not only bring in the optimization in terms of efficiencies from an operations perspective, but also from a cost optimization perspective. So, for example, one of the key things we take advantage of is when we go to any company, you use their bathrooms and they have soap dispensers and paper towel dispensers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, those are things that we have now said we have made smart devices. So it's just in time replenishment. Your customer gets the benefit back that you're not wasting, or there isn't wastage in terms of hand soap, et cetera, et cetera. But you also optimize your workforce in terms of where do you need to go, when do you need to go. And also in terms of tracking that, you're also able to understand, did you go there? And have checklists that are electronic. So I don't know if there's something that always used to make me wonder when you visited a bathroom and they had a little piece of paper at the on the door, and then someone signed, and then there's a huge gap, and then someone signs again. What happens in those hours? I mean, those are the type of things that we've made electronic. Mm. You know, so that you're able to manage the workforce.
How much can you automate it? I mean, can you put an IoT sensor in a bathroom to let you know?
Oh, definitely. From an IoT perspective, I mean, that's one of the key technologies that we use. But people counting, you know, so maybe, you know, you work out that after every 50 people that go in or 20 people that go in, there has to be
a service
going in there from an IoT perspective. So, you know, the use cases are immense.
Yeah.
There's a lot of use cases that you can come to, but also making it financially viable, you know, and so from an IoT perspective, I think, you know, in terms of adopting the technology, there's key things that need to happen in terms of how you communicate securely. Mm. So those are things that you need to make sure that you partner with the right providers. And then also the cost of ownership of the device, because you've got lots of people that are talking about platforms out there. But they say, if you got the device and you can send me the data, then I can help you do the fancy stuff and the predictive analytics. So we've taken a little bit of a different approach and started a homegrown type of, you know, view in terms of that particular platform. And we believe that you're going to see lovely things coming out from that in the future, in the near future.
Are you seeing a lot of interest amongst your clients for more automation in their facilities management? And if so, what's driving that?
So, yes, I think cost. Is one of the key things is driving that. And also the fact that they also want to understand where there's lots of wastage and revenue leakage in their businesses. So it might not be visible when you have these manual processes and also optimized in terms of processes. Mm-hmm. You know, so why do you have such a long queue? Can we change things around, et cetera, et cetera? But I think the demand is twofold in terms of that. One is that I guess everyone's treating data as a strategic asset, including our clients, okay? And from a behavioral perspective, they want to understand that. That's number one. Even with services that they offer their customers. So that's number one. And number two is that there's a huge focus on security, and what does it do with us putting this stuff on the cloud, or you know what happens to our customers' information if you're storing anything, or particularly in our security and protection division, there's a lot going on in terms of tech that customers are asking, clients and. Are asking for better ways to protect their assets. So, for example, we're
talking about physical security.
Physical security, but using technology to enable that. Mm-hmm. So, drone technology is one of that we look in terms of perimeter, you know, monitoring, etc. But also, the key thing is, for example, you know, tagging and understanding from a facial recognition perspective, known. You know, surveillance or criminals or people of interest that's on there. Also, understanding patterns in terms of, you know, when is their feet in the store, and do you need to up your security? Mm-hmm. From a camera perspective, I mean, cameras are normally the basis of any security, physical security system out there. But it's using it to do more in terms of, okay, how do you optimize your queues? Do you need another teller? Mm-hmm. You know, because your queues are long. So the sky's the limit in terms of diversifying the workplace from a, you know, an integration perspective with technology. And it's not just the, you know, the typical use cases that you find. It's use cases that you sometimes don't even think about that you enable.
Okay. Yeah. So you must be, I mean, looking out for new solutions all the time. I mean, it's, in a business like this, you must be looking for, speaking to vendors about all sorts of advances in automation around facilities management.
Yes, definitely. We speak to a lot of people. We have a very small group IT team, okay, but very, capable and seasoned individuals that firstly, you know, have business acumen and know the industry. I'm pretty new to it, so. Mm-hmm. So I definitely rely on them to give me the best view and best fit. But I think because we are so constrained from a cost perspective, because if we take on any cost, it has to be passed on to that client. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be competitive, even though clients are getting tech, and in the long run you can show efficiencies and saving, they're not prepared to take, you know, the extra leap. Mm-hmm. So quite a bit of our solutions are going out there, understanding what's there, and understanding with the, the architecture and the, stack that we have, is there any way that we can optimize it in-house? I think the one approach is that we've picked core ERP systems and core bespoke systems for these entities, and we've got very, very simple rules. If it's native to that particular, you know, stack or solution, the analytics must come out of there. But if it's cross, you know, channel, then you move to your data lake and, you know, mm-hmm. understanding those type of things. So there's a few principles. We have very, very good relationships with our third-party providers. We do not have an in-house development team. We have, you know, business analytics and guys that do configuration. Some people can do coding, but I wouldn't call us an IT shop in terms of development. Mm-hmm. We use those expertise where we have, you know, niche people that can go and work with these guys, with, you know, our solution providers to give us the best bit. Okay. And I think the new thing that I'm quite excited about is that, you know, modernizing the data warehouse. We've put in Azure Synapse. So all the data pipelines and systems now feed into it. It's not three core systems. So that's firstly the opportunity. There's opportunities for structured and unstructured data to go in. And I guess the sky's the limit in terms of what are we doing with this data now. So we've identified quite a few use cases in terms of how we're going to, you know, optimize that, et cetera. I think quite a few is focused on efficiencies, okay, where we save time. I guess time is one of the key things. And then I think standardization across the board in terms of other solutions. So if we're doing a procurement solution, what is the group procurement solution and why do we have it? You know, I think in the past, what happened is each pillar had their own flavor. So that's the consolidation and standardization that's already started and being optimized now.
How do you work with the rest of the C-suite within Tsebo and also the board of directors? And what do you believe, I mean, how do you believe that interface between IT leadership and the rest of the leadership in an organization should function in an organization like yours?
In an organization like mine. So I don't think, firstly, in order to be an effective CIO in this particular industry and engage, you have to be knowledgeable. Okay. And you have to keep up with the trends and you should be able to speak the lingo. Mm-hmm. I think it gives firstly the stakeholders confidence that you are, going down the right path, you know enough, and, you know, we don't need expensive consultants to come on board. And because we have a thin team, I guess one of the other things is growing and, you know, continuous learning in that particular team. But to manage the C-suite and the board, I think it's initially when I started, it was quite difficult, I guess, in terms of getting buy-in, because I think for as an autonomous unit, there wasn't the rigid standards and governance that you put in terms of, you know, IT governance, best practices, etc. And that was a journey. But having those engagements, those stakeholder engagements, showing the value, showing the benefit, improving the bottom line, increasing profitability, those are the key things. And also, I think from a board perspective, in terms of being a private equity company, to get the return on investment, they also want to know that we are, you know, keeping up to trends, we are doing, you know, the best practices, et cetera, et cetera. So having a robust, convincing business case for initiatives that you want to do. And I guess my first exposure to board at that, when I first joined, was, you know, saying a little bit about, you know, putting a IT strategic roadmap together, putting down IT principles, et cetera, et cetera. Although there were principles in place, but it was not formalized, you know, and each, so it was getting that together. And I had an opportunity to do a presentation to the board, particularly around, you know, where we are from an IT perspective, where we're going, what's our IT roadmap, what's our vision. Well, at that point in time, was 25. But I also sneaked in a slide in terms of, you know, my wish list. And out of that, I guess that's where, you know, we were able to get through the business case and board approval for the data warehouse component. Okay. And I guess one of the key things is that from an AI perspective, or from a technology perspective, the CEO, so we have two CEOs, Dr. Chris Jardine and Tim Waters. Dr. Chris Jardine is a hardcore techie.
Okay. I know him. Yes.
You know him, yes. So he's a hardcore techie. And it's great to have, you know, that type of support in terms of understanding how you want to drive this technology culture and make sure that you future-proof, et cetera. It's always good to have someone that you can advocate for you as well.
Yes.
In terms of the roadmap and the mandate.
I sometimes wonder if it's easier or more difficult for a CIO to have a CEO who is tech savvy and understands what tech can do for his business.
Well, I guess it has its pros and its cons, but to be honest, I think it has more pros than cons. Mm-hmm. Because I think it pushes you to be best breed, okay? It pushes you to stay relevant. And you've got to make sure that if you're saying you can't do something, you really can't do something. So I just think it brings out the best. And it may not be everyone's cup of tea, but I like the
challenge.
The challenge and also the interaction, I think. You know, why can't we? But, you know, I did this on, and AI wrote this for me, and it's easy, and yeah.
Do you think you're going to begin? I mean, technology is becoming so fundamental to business. Do you think that we're going to see more and more CIOs progressing into the CEO role because of their understanding of the way tech is going to transform their industries?
I think that's the next hop. I don't think we're there yet, to be honest. I mean, but if we really sober up and look at how the CIO role has changed over the years, the CIO needs to understand those business processes, needs to, from a contractual perspective, you know, in terms of, I guess, the financial management side of things, you have to be hardcore in order to understand, you know, is this hitting my balance sheet or is this hitting my income statement kind of thing, you know.
CIO has really moved from a technical role into more of a business role over the last decade or so.
Exactly.
In the past, people probably wanted to know, why is the mail server up, or, you know, why is my computer not working? To now being on the board, or at least engaging with the rest of the C-suite on cost and innovation and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it's also... So the one good thing is that I think that the right level, so in most organizations, the org structure does not promote a natural, I guess, move from a career succession perspective, mm-hmm. CIO to CEO. Because normally the CIO reports into the COO or the CFO,
yeah.
Right? And that needs to change. So I'm quite lucky I report directly into the CEO, and it does make a difference. Mm. I mean, it's chalk and cheese in terms of moving the technology agenda, having that, you know, exposure to the CEO, to the board, et cetera.
Yeah.
And it's through that enablement you're able to change things and you're able to transform things. Mm. But if you're too far removed, it becomes more difficult.
And if you're reporting into the CFO, money's always the issue, yes.
Yeah.
And IT becomes a cost center that needs to have its cost line reduced every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, I want to change the subject just a little bit. I know you're particularly passionate as well about the topic of cybersecurity. Chat a little bit about you specifically have stated that you have strong... Sorry, Dedek, I'm just going to rephrase that. Do you want another audio marker?
No.
So I just want to change subject for a little bit then. You have a particular focus on cybersecurity, and indeed you have strong views on why security must be embedded at the foundation of digital innovation.
Yes.
Maybe expand on that a little bit and answer how you go about doing that within an organization.
Okay. So firstly, yes, it's foundational, and it's not a nice to have. I think that's the first sell that you need to have, because sometimes it's a grudge purchase when it moves up the line in terms of, am I taking cybersecurity insurance, et cetera, to protect me from these acts. But I think the key thing is that your vulnerability is your weakest link, okay? And that normally is the human that sits in front of the system, PC, and it's not because it's an intentional, you know, action or activity that happens. So how do you, as a leader in cybersecurity, make this less intuitive for the user and more process-driven and system-enforced and solution-enforced? And definitely, there's always going to be loopholes. So there's always a new scam that comes out that's probably gonna get you, right? So from a cyber perspective, I think my passion is always, okay, so firstly, my passion's always been about risk and governance, because if you look at my master's, I proposed a conceptual framework for governance in terms of innovation, okay? And normally people say, you know, governance kills innovation, but no. So that's where the passion comes in from, in terms of doing things right the first time, okay? And so in terms of SEBO as such, I think it's more a proactive risk-based risk management approach, okay? And also to understand how do we continuously optimize and improve. And the key thing there is that how do we make sure that the cyber defenses are appropriate to firstly catch the threat? Because before it gets the human being, there's many, many guardrails that you could put in and gates before it gets there. Mm. So block things even before they get into the organization, et cetera, for example. And then in terms of the human element in terms of continuously educating users around the threats. So, for example, you know, phishing. So one of the things that we actively doing is running these scenarios and training sessions. And you'll be surprised around the candidates that fail, because these are the people that you expect to pass, you know, and are more tech savvy and are more aware and conscious about what's going on. So that's, you know, the never-ending cycle in terms of how do you make this human-centric, the cyber threats? Because there's lots of fancy tech out there, etc. And I believe from a technology perspective, the you know, we can do perimeter protection, firewall protection, et cetera, et cetera. But I think we have to solve the human problem.
Yeah.
And it's
and
not
if someone
easy.
Clicks on a dodgy link.
Exactly. Exactly.
So and that training has to be continuous.
It right? has to be continuous, but also you have to continuously scan the environment. So yes, there are, I guess, best of breed products that we've settled on in terms of protection from a cyber threat, cybersecurity right. perspective. But as soon as someone knocks on my door and says, can I come speak to you about cybersecurity? I say, yes, come tell me. Because it's constantly changing, you know, and you're definitely going to learn a trick or two if you constantly engage. And it also makes you reassess the fail-safes that you've put in place. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, sometimes you do have blind spots and you can have clever people out there that are doing the best things, but they are blind spots. And you don't have to be the expert, but make sure that you have the right people in the room and you're having the right discussions and also understand reputationally what this would do to you, to your business. I think the reputational damage for our business would be huge. Mm-hmm. You know, we take care of very, very, you know, elite customers. And if there is a cyber threat or a cyber attack, I mean, that definitely is going to get them to lose confidence in your
services. Is your IT environment mainly on-prem or
no,
mostly cloud?
So when I got there, everything was on-prem. 99% of our workloads are on cloud.
On cloud now.
Yeah.
Doing it in the cloud, does it make security easier or more difficult?
So, for me, I don't think security is my business. Mm-hmm. Facility management is my business. That's the way I think about it.
Right.
But in order for you, so the first thing is don't outsource what you can't manage. Okay. So you need to know your stuff in terms of, I don't know, multifunctional authentication, encryption, you know, those type of things. I mean, you do need to keep up with the trends, but you also need to make sure that you find the right provider that gives you the comfort that they're doing that. And for me, from a cloud perspective, in terms of engaging the right partner, there's a very easy way to understand if you're putting your eggs in the wrong basket or not. So the first thing is, do you have a SOC report? Are you ISO 27001 accredited? You know, those type of governance frameworks, et cetera, et cetera. And also, I mean, you do need a managed assurance approach in terms of security and security threats. But from a general control perspective, you also need your external audit. You know, and seeing that we work with a lot of third-party niche providers, it's very difficult for me to go in and audit the environment. So I either insist on a SOC report or something of the similar, or we do, you know, a physical review in our annual cycle. But I truly believe that if you partner with the right people and if they have a security hat on, because one of our IT principles is security first, zero trust, okay? To get to that is very, very difficult, and it also costs a lot of money. So we try and make sure that either contractually, but also in terms of delivering the service that it's there, and also try to understand punitively if something does go wrong. Because you only look at your contract when something's gone wrong.
Mm.
So we do take the time up front to understand that. And then one of the other key things in terms of making sure that you pick the right provider is that, you know, customer interviews and, you know, understanding our after-sales services, what type of experience, I think, is a must. It's a standard, I guess, RFP, RFQ type of exercise, but it's amazing how honest customers are that use products. You know, they'll say, "Don't do this." I mean, I do the same if I'm asked with, you know, by other people in terms of what's the no goes and what's the goes. So if they ask me about D365 in terms of trying to do the approach from a vanilla perspective, don't. understand the nuances in terms of the 20% variation, because that's going to give you the sleepless nights, not the standard vanilla stuff. Yeah.
But I think some organizations, not many, but some take the approach that, oh, we're going to outsource, we're going to put all of our IT in the cloud, our cloud provider can look after it. That's not...
No.
You can't do that.
No, you can't.
You have to secure your own cloud infrastructure as well.
Yes.
I think many organizations, well, not many, but a few organizations make the mistake of thinking, because it's being managed offsite now by a cloud provider, that I don't have to do anything.
No, you do have to do anything. You do have to do, monitoring and understanding the threats that have come in. So it's quite interesting, because one of the, I think, the key reporting matrix that we do is, you know, how many cyber threats did we have, you know, in this particular month or this particular period,
right,
which is something that we track. And something that I generally share with the C-suite to say, like, listen, I know you hate the fact that we have to buy security software. Not hate the fact. They prefer to be cheaper. Let's be
right.
They prefer to be protected. They're responsible, but when they realize, you know, you've prevented 50,000 attacks or I don't know how many number of attacks, then it becomes tangible to say, whoa, this could have been real. This could have been 50,000 events that had caused me reputational damage that I've stopped.
Yes.
So that's the good part of
it, I think. Where is AI going to take us in cybersecurity? Obviously, cyber attackers are going to use it to try and test networks to see where they can get in and use, like this term copilot, they could use these AI copilots to test the breaches of company systems, but equally AI could be used by the good guys to fight off cyber attacks. Where do you see all of this going? Is it going to become more and more automated? Are we going to see AIs fighting each other, trying to get into systems? What do you see as the role of IT and AI in cybersecurity going forward?
So I think it's twofold. I think, one, it's going to try and improve the security posture, okay, by companies. And there's going to be a lot of, I guess, service providers, software service providers that are going to use that as their selling point. But I also think that from an opportunity perspective in terms of how you think about maturing your defense against these cybersecurity attacks is using AI internally to create that. So, you know, hackathons were one of the key things. But I think, you know, AI is going to replace that, you know, and take on that role. And I guess, and this is the key thing, Duncan, is that AI and the use of AI and, you know, the governance and, you know, the policies around AI is really, really unregulated right now in most countries, right? I think Britain is one of the few countries that are trying to get a handle on this. But I think seeing that we've gone down this road from an AI perspective, the first thing that we did was understand how do we use AI responsibly? What is the governance around that? How is it ethical? And how do we make sure that our people understand what it means? So, you know, never ever just send something out. So there's a whole, I guess, people change management side that needs to happen. And there's a whole level of policy that also needs to happen within companies in terms of best practice use from an AI perspective. And I think we'll see this landscape evolve because this is a hot topic, you know, everywhere now. And I just wish that at the time that I was choosing my PhD thesis topic, that this was one of the things that I chose because the sky's the limit in terms of the excitement. But yeah, I will continue to maybe write some papers about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you before we conclude, we had a great guest on Meet the CIO last month, Carissa Varma, who's a former group CISO at Vodacom and at Old Mutual and has recently joined Microsoft. Now, she's particularly passionate about advancing women in the cybersecurity space, and she leads the South African chapter of an organization called Women in Cybersecurity. I understand that you're also passionate about gender diversity in tech. First of all, why is it important? And secondly, what needs to be done, in your view, to encourage more young women to choose technology as a career?
So I, firstly, why it's passionate for me and why it's important to me is because I guess I grew up in the tech industry bottom up, okay? And when I got into the tech industry, it was truly male-dominated. It's still so very male-dominated. But women do have a voice now. So for me, the most interesting conversations that I have with ladies, okay, is I aspire to be you. I want to get to where you are. And how did you do it? You know, it seems like, do I have a recipe in terms of how do you get there?
Lots of hard work, I'm guessing.
yes, hard work. And I also think being authentic as well.
Okay.
And not afraid. And, you know, there were many occasions when I stood in boardrooms and I was asked an opinion and it was not, you know, the popular opinion. My mind would always say, but what's the worst that could happen? They could fire me. And at that point in time, the courage would just come up and, yeah, there I go and speak my mind. Although later on I'd say, gosh, that was a ballsy move because you have bills to pay, you know. But I guess the thing about it is being authentic, okay, and also paying it forward because there were not many women that were willing to help you as a woman, okay? It was always, are you competing? Do we have to compete? And I believe in terms of encouraging ladies to progress up the career path, is that they need that support from people that are in positions that they're able to support, you know, the growth and the mentorship, etc., of these ladies. But I think the key thing is that we need to advocate for the removal of gender bias, okay? And sometimes it's unconscious bias because, you know, I sat around a table of 13 CIOs when I first joined, previous company, and everyone said they weren't gender biased. And then what I did was, when I got into the company, I said to HR, can you tell me how many women are in positions, you know, senior management positions? Beside myself, there were only three other women. Why? And is it work policies? Is it the fact that you need more support having a career and a family, you know? So those are the type of things that become very important to empower women. And also, I guess when I was in that phase of trying to, you know, progress and develop and get to where I was going, there was no one telling me about financial freedom and, you know, what you should do. It's the softer skills that we need to empower the ladies with because they're clever people. They know what needs to happen. You have a chat with them on the sidebar. Oh, brilliant. But put them in that position. And also, there's a lot of cultural barriers. So I think in terms of some of the ladies that I've mentored, culturally, they come from cultures that are subservient, including mine. And they don't leave that at home. They bring it to the office. So it's our accountability and responsibility as women to empower and break these shackles, you know. So, yes, that's why I'm very, very passionate. And I never, ever pass up an opportunity if someone reaches out to me to say mentorship. And I also think it's not only about women. It's also about the men that support you as well. So for me, there are some brilliant guys that have believed in me and gave me a chance to get to where I am right now. And I'm forever grateful and thankful for that because it's not all men that are in this, you know, eat or be eaten type of scenario. So we also have to salute them as well, I think, and bring them into the conversation.
Do you think we know there's a serious skill shortage in the IT space and particularly in the cybersecurity space.
Yeah.
Do you think that society itself discourages young girls from considering careers in tech? Do you think there's a perception in society, oh, tech, computers, that must be for the boys? And if there is, how do we change that as a society?
So I think that quite a bit of the foundation from a society perspective and I speak of Africa, right, mm-hmm. is very matriarchal. Okay, so there wasn't that father figure, you know, in the past. And there's also, I guess, generational biases that come in there. And I think it's a yes and a no. I think the more and more we start penetrating kids at you know, grassroots level, at primary school level, mm-hmm. That's where we unleash the whole potential. It has to start from the bottom up, because once you've gotten to a certain level of maturity, it's very hard to change that mindset and say it's a boy, you know. So, you know, like my nephew, he would say he wants a Lula doll, okay, and his cousins tease him because dolls are for girls, you know, that kind of thing. But he is just empowered. He's like, this is my doll, and I'm gonna do this. And that's the mindset that needs to happen. But it's all about education. And I think there's so many programs that are happening from a STEM perspective at that level. But is it enough? No, it's not. Mm-hmm. And we do need to do more in that space. And we also do need to embellish the importance of this particular role. I have a friend from F&B. She's now a CEO of one of the divisions. Okay, she and I started the same way. And her father is late now, but one of the things that he kept asking her, she came from a small town of Alice, he kept asking her, is like, when are you going to be the branch manager? And she was the person doing solutions to, you know, to take care of branch managers. Right. So it's just that perception that we need to change.
Yeah.
So I always think of that story.
Okay, great. Well, I think it's a good place to leave it. Yoshin Padiachi is Group IT Director at Tsebo Solutions Group. Thank you so much for your time speaking to Tech Central today, and to meet the CIO. It's much appreciated.
Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you.